Welcome to the System Speak podcast, a podcast about dissociative identity disorder. If you are new to the podcast, we recommend starting at the beginning episodes and listen in order to hear our story and what we have learned through this endeavor. Current episodes may be more applicable to longtime listeners and are likely to contain more advanced topics, emotional or other triggering content, and/or reference earlier episodes that provide more context to what we are currently learning and experiencing. As always, please care for yourself during and after listening to the podcast. Thank you.
I just want to say that we are getting ready to do this to recap the last of those attachment strategy session we went to, like all the way back on the first day. And I said, we still need to do that. Shame and attachment. And then I said, because I am very attached to my shame.
Yeah. I mean, in all seriousness, that might have been one of the only secure attachments we had growing up, was to our own shame.
Oh, snap. Where did that come from? Why? Why do you say these things? When I say you are insightful and profound, I am not mocking. What just happened? What did you say?
That our attachment to our shame might have been one of our only secure attachments growing up.
Is that why it's so hard to change it?
Maybe.
Ew. I do not like this at all.
I do not like this, Sam. I am.
I don't even have a Sam. That I know of. I never asked. Okay, so we are back to Ana Gomez because it was painful. So we took a couple days off from Ana Gomez. Thanks a lot, Ana Gomez.
Really, also, thanks a lot, Ana Gomez. It was really good stuff.
Oh my goodness, right?
Yeah.
And I believe, I don't want to say this wrong. Maybe we should look it up and I could put it in the show notes. But I feel like Ana Gomez and our friend Jill Hosey co-authored a book together about children and adolescents, or maybe chapters in a book.
Maybe. I can see what I find right now while we look. Make everyone listen to me.
Is it Safe and Sound?
Safe and Sound. Jill and Ana did a presentation about it, it looks like. Looks like they're on the child and adolescent special interest group.
Yes, and they're writing the guidelines with Alexis, I think. I feel like we have now conflated several things.
Okay, well, they are both together at the same institute.
What is it called?
Agate Institute, Trauma-Informed Education by Ana Gomez.
What is the website?
Agate or Agate, Agate Institute. So AGATEINSTITUTE.org. And they're both listed on their training team. Of course, Ana is because she's the founder, but Jill Hosey is also one of the trainers. It just says right there that she's registered.
I feel like we have put five, Alexis is probably laughing at us right now. I feel like we have put five things together and also left out the one I was trying to say. They did chapters or a book together. Maybe other people did too. Something. It has slipped away from me. We will find that out. I will ask Jill herself.
You could always just text Jill and find out.
I'd be like, can you tell me what is the thing? So I'm actually going to finish my EMDR training with Jill there at that institute, by the way, but I haven't got to talk about that yet. So we are still avoiding attachment shame discussion.
Yeah, we
are. So if you want to scroll back to your document.
There we go.
We're so slippery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we are back to the Ana Gomez. It was the attachment strategies, is what we already talked about, avoidant and approach, which historically we call anxious attachment.
Mm-hmm. And then disorganized.
We talked about disorganized attachment, mm-hmm. putting those together a little bit. It's been very painful, so it's been a couple days. I don't even know when this will air. Maybe I can edit it on the plane. Edit. That's still the hardest word for me to say in English.
You can edit it.
Edit.
You can do some editing on the plane.
Oh, that was well played. Well played. Okay, so on where did we leave off?
Well,
hold on. I need a breath because I'm so scared. I am deep brain reorienting myself. Bam! There's the shock. Okay. That was epic. What an intro.
Right?
This is how much we don't want to talk about these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
We even had a donut, which almost made me sick. My body does not like donuts and candy.
You're not a sweet fan.
I am not.
You're a savory person.
Yeah, buddy.
So savory.
Hello.
I am a sweet person. I don't know if we've talked about that.
You are sweet. I am not nice at all.
No, I mean, I enjoy sweet things.
Yes.
Yeah. Which we already talked about my candy wine, so.
Did we tell that story?
I think we did.
Oh, my
goodness. On the first one, yeah. Okay. So where we left off, we had talked about all the attachment strategies, and we'd also talked about that misconception of calmness being regulated in children.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh. And then we checked in, and we were very calm, and so we checked out of the podcast.
We were calm because we had checked out. So let's just stop podcasting our dissociated state and move on with the day.
Yeah.
But we took good care of ourselves because we got Barbie tickets. We went for a walk. We found excellent queso around the corner.
We did.
We're going to go after we record this again, actually.
Right.
For a walk and a farewell to Texas.
And more queso and candy wine.
Oh. I will eat the queso and you can drink the candy wine.
Yes. So the next little note I have, are you ready to actually get in? When the defense systems.
What does that mean?
Like.
Fight, flight, and freeze.
Fight, flight, freeze, those things. When they're highly rigid. They are typically generational.
Whoa. That's right. This was heavy.
Uh-huh.
I am quickly remembering why we have avoided this for days.
For days.
So I want to go back and just clarify the words because that helps me stay present with what's really hard. When we say defense systems, we mean that those neurological, biological responses.
Automatic responses.
We're not bad behavior, not bad people, not bad parts. Literally neurobiological responses to trauma.
Right.
So fight, flight, freeze, fawning, all the things.
Mm-hmm. Flop.
Flop, submission, attach, cry.
All the things.
That's not our favorite.
No. No.
Definitely attach, cry, avoidance. That is a strategy that says I need something. Not happening. Mm-mm. Okay, so we're not even going to talk about that's bad that we so don't want to talk about this. We would rather allude to attach, cry. Oh my goodness. Okay. So when you say rigid, mm-hmm. that those responses are rigid, what does that mean?
Well, it's that she said highly rigid. So like instead of fluctuating between like maybe responding based on the situation, is my understanding?
Yes.
It's just this is how we do this always.
So sometimes we have people, I'm going to say other people who come to our offices instead of talk about ourselves for just a minute. Sometimes we have people come to our offices who sort of walk through the trauma responses. This happens and they have a flight response. This happens, they have a freeze response. This happens, they have a fight response. Mm-hmm. But we also have some people who come to our office. We are fine. We have some people who come to our, I'm just saying our office, because we're going to open it when we get back.
We are.
We have something to look forward to. Mm-hmm. Ooh, really don't want to talk about these things. We have some people who come to our office who are really flighters or fighters or freezers.
Floppers.
Fawners.
Oh, no, no.
We don't have any. Attach criers.
We have zero fawners.
One of us. Okay. Right. Nobody here in this room is a fawner or an attach crier. But when that is the case, when there is a reinforced default response of almost always I go to this one, as opposed to it being in context to what kind of threat or what your options are, which is the healthy flight, fight, or freeze.
That's the way our bodies are designed to work.
Right.
Yeah.
But instead, there's like an overriding default. So this is what it sounds like to me. It goes back to our new book.
The problems with complex trauma therapy.
That there are these social contracts from our childhood that give us, this is what you have to do to be safe and approved of, which keeps you in the pack as pack animals, or avoid punishment. So for safety, these are the things you're allowed to express. So in this way, we're talking about neurobiologically, we have learned that because of intergenerational trauma, it is safer to respond with some responses more than others.
Right. And even we have been conditioned to respond that way because that is the way our caregivers have been conditioned to respond.
Be invisible and you are safe.
Can I also add, when you say avoid punishment, avoid shame? Because sometimes punishment isn't like a physical or a yelling. Sometimes it really is just shame or rejection.
I love that distinction. I think for me, shame was used as punishment.
Yeah.
Which is why I lumped it together. But it really is a very specific piece. So I appreciate that being made explicit.
Yeah. I just know for people that like to minimize their trauma because it was relational. Hearing something like that about punishment, that would be an easy way to say, oh, I never got punished. Like, that is no big deal. But that's not the only thing.
So much even control happens through relationalness and through neglectness.
Deprivation.
Deprivation, the good that is missing.
Yeah.
The nurture that never was.
Oh, that sounds like a punk rock song.
A really depressing documentary. Okay.
Okay. Oh, and she also says that to treat that, she says that for children to treat that, it has to be done at the systemic level, meaning that parents have to be, or caregivers have to be included in treatment. And you actually have to treat their attachment wounds.
The parents.
The parents. And then teach them how to show up and heal their children's attachment wounds.
Because the children are not actually the problem.
Right. That's the next thing I wrote down, is that misbehavior doesn't exist for children. She wrote that, like Christine Vorner says, there are no bad children, right?
It is impossible to be a bad child.
Yeah. She says misbehavior doesn't exist. Children's behavior is a child reacting to their environment and providing information about the environment and their experience.
That really sucker punched me for two reasons. One, I am a parent of a whole lot of children and they have a whole lot of stuff going on. Yeah. So it was hard to hear and uncomfortable to hear, because I immediately went to, what am I doing wrong that is causing this in the children? And I think that is partly misapplication of what she was saying.
Yeah.
And also continuing to, this is why we're in therapy. This is why we're taking care of things. This is why we're responsive to them. Mm-hmm. And the second layer, like that hit first, the second layer that hit was a layer of really uncomfortable relief, because I have been so shamed by my family for being the bad kid of the family, which is so weird because I'm the one who finished high school first, and I'm the one who went to college first, and I'm the one who didn't get pregnant or married as an adolescent. And not shaming those in contrast, but in a shiny, happy world, that's what I was told to do. Purity culture, go get an education. Like, I did the things that I was told to do, and I still got it wrong.
Right.
Like, I was still the bad one.
Yeah.
But no one told me about the other things. The other things were not explicit.
Yeah.
Like relational things, right? Mm-hmm. So being like the black sheep or the bad one or the runaway or the whatever, the bad kid in the family, completely rejected and shamed for decades, mm-hmm, for choices, for being gay, for talking about trauma, for all the things, to hear that it was in response to what I was experiencing. You know what it reminds me of? When Kathleen Adams came on the podcast, and remember, she just talked the whole time, mm-hmm, and just did a presentation, which, mm-hmm, is fine. But one of the things that she talked about was how when no one listens to the children, they have to start speaking in metaphors.
Yes. Yeah.
And I thought that is one of the things I was in trouble for a lot, was my metaphors, mm-hmm, of this feels like this, or this is what's happening, right? Because if you say this feels like this, then that is simile. It's not, mm-hmm, metaphor, it's simile. And you're still not heard. And you can't express feelings or point out that something is wrong. So then you speak in metaphor and use that narrative, mm-hmm, of this is happening, and you're trying to describe it, or pictures or art or stories or whatever. And it's like, stop lying, stop talking, stop da da da. You're bad, you're bad, you're bad, you're wrong. You're so wrong, you're not even in the family anymore.
Right.
And she's saying, no, that's trauma. Mm-hmm. This is in response to what they are experiencing. And not only their experience, they are experiencing the trauma of the parents, of the, right, caregivers.
The parents' unresolved and unacknowledged trauma. Can I say, for your first layer about children with problem, like with behaviors, can I just say that I think, remember, kids sometimes and adults are responding not to what's happening now, but to what they're remembering, cues from the past. So even though now they have a very safe environment, they are also still responding to the past sometimes.
The pediatrician, mm-hmm, at one of the children's well child checks just 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm, actually reminded Nathan of this, and he reminded me, and I felt terrible that I did not hold this, because I know, see, shame, mm-hmm, automatically, oh, I should have known, right, this, because I'm a clinician in trauma and I know the things. But the pediatrician was like, I don't think this is bad behavior. I don't think this is you failing the children. This is new developmental phase, and all the trauma comes back, and we have to reintegrate,
right,
it.
Right. It's the spiral staircase.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the information when children might be acting out, even though things now are safe enough, it is still healing from what happened before. And so they're responding to what has already happened.
Right. So to give an example of this without saying which child, just for protection, one of the things that has happened is one of the children that was living with me was like, I need to go back to Oklahoma. Not, there was not big drama with us other than what was going on with that child. But that child was like, I need my father. And then very idealizing
of why they needed the father, right? So, but okay, this for this particular child to express what they need is a big deal.
Yeah.
So I had to respond to that because that's what mattered most. Everything else we can sort out later. What they needed was to be heard. Mm-hmm. So I immediately got a ticket. Thank goodness I had the money saved because I was about to buy tickets for summer. Got their ticket, got them to Oklahoma. They got connected finally last week to therapy with a new therapist, right? And they're starting. It was not about Nathan at all. It was about their biological father. Mm. They are at a new developmental phase. Mm-hmm. And they are the only, out of all the children. So I think it's public. I think people know that we have maintained contact with their biological families. We have tried to support that in the ways that we could when it was safe to do so. There have been seasons like during the pandemic where it was easier than not, or depending where we lived or not, but we call them, we make video calls, we do in-person visits. They have the same PO box as everyone else has, like that they can write to or send things to. And so we have stayed connected with the biological families in that way. Some of them, their parents are not actually together, but we have separate visits or do what we need to do. It's not perfect, but we have tried so hard. But this particular child, we don't know who the father is. Like, the biological mother was using substances at the time. And we do not, like, we've even helped her go through her social media. We've contacted a couple people. Like, we cannot, at this point, we've done DNA testing. At this point, we cannot figure out who the actual father is. Like, we don't need anything from the father. We don't mean pressure on the father, just for attachment. And so for this child at a new developmental stage, something triggered or got cued. I'm still working on changing my language. Something got cued for the need of a father, and then started acting out in ways we had not seen since they first came to us in foster care, like as a toddler. And so it's like, okay, food anxiety is back. Screaming is back, crying is back, what is happening? Mm-hmm. And we would try to respond to those things, but it was surface, so it wasn't meeting the need. So when they said, we need to go back to Oklahoma, it's like, on it, you can go in the morning, we will get you a ticket right now, here's your ticket, I will help you pack, let's get you there, what else do you need? Do you know that we're okay? Here's a picture of us so you can remember that we're okay. Got the child there. And they're like, oh, it's not about Nathan. It's that I don't have a biological dad. How am I supposed to know who I am?
That's so hard.
Right? Right? But getting them the support, and they do have extra friends in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So adding support and increasing support, even though I can't solve what the problem is, I can tend to the relational need to give them support while they grieve, because I can't fix that.
Right.
And grieving that is appropriate.
Yeah.
People forget this about adoption, how much grief is involved. And so that's like, all of that was happening inside me.
Wow.
Really inside them, that child.
Mm-hmm. And so you were seeing the behaviors and feeling shame about not being a good enough parent, that they didn't have to have behaviors, but really it was behaviors about a new level of grieving what has already happened.
Right. And but you were attending to it.
And you were able to see it finally and tend to it in the ways that you could and that they needed. The next thing we talked about, or she talked about, was motivational systems. And she showed a couple different models or theories of motivational systems, meaning like the systems that we have that motivate us to do things. And almost always number one is attachment, right? Our attachment motivation system is strongest. And I like to tell clients this. I cannot remember where I heard it in one of the trainings, but they talked about when a mother gives birth to a child, and like even when the baby is still attached to the umbilical cord and they put the baby on the mom's stomach, baby will climb, like move its way up and attach to her breast, but they're not hungry because they're still literally attached to the umbilical cord and have had all the food they need. It is about attachment. And the moment we're born, we're seeking attachment.
It was Christine Forner.
There you go.
Last year.
Yeah.
When we saw that.
Yeah. So like, I think that really helps a lot of people understand the importance of attachment. Like that the moment we're born into this world, that's our drive. And it gives an infant moments old strength to climb up to their mother.
An infant who can't climb yet.
Right.
Or crawl yet. Right. Or move hardly.
But they can.
They will do it.
For attachment. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's, so there's in, there's different theories, but I can't say the name. Leote. In that theory, there's the attachment system, the caregiving system, the sexuality system, the play system, the competition ranking system, and the cooperation and collaboration system.
Ooh, I do not have that online.
Okay. Well, we don't have to talk. She didn't talk a lot about them other than to talk about how they can get, when we have attachment wounds, some of our other systems can get like cross-wired with our attachment system. So like if we have a caregiving, if we have an attachment response where when we take care of someone, we get attachment, then our caregiving system, motivation system, gets intertwined with our attachment system, motivation system. And so then we are like, really good caretakers, because that's how we get our attachment. Not because we actually want to take care of people, but because we want to attach. And she talked a lot about like our sexuality motivation, which can be about
deliciousness.
Oh my goodness. Can be about connecting, but also can be about like reproduction. But when that is messed up in childhood, so you have an attachment wound that is also paired with sexual abuse. And if the sexual abuse brings a sense of attachment, then that can lead adults in later in life to have a addiction to sex, not because they actually want sex, but because they're looking for the attachment. Because those things have gotten crossed. Does that make sense?
It's like it got paired, like Bluetooth.
Right.
Attachment.
And sexuality.
And sexuality.
They got paired. And so then, because our attachment drive is so strong, it's the number one thing we go for, always.
So we get it where we can get it.
We get it where we can get it. Then the, I know, that's a lot. Let's just zoom past that.
Moving on.
But the other thing she talked about is play and how our play system is so important, especially in children. That's how we learn, right? It's that curiosity. It's how we learn how to engage in the world. And we can't have our play system if our danger system is turned on. Like it shuts down play. And she talked about studies with rats. Do you remember any of this? The rat studies?
It's blurry. Okay. It's so blurry.
So they studied play in rats, which, a fun fact, I had to write this down. Rats can actually laugh.
So, nice.
Yeah. And like genuine laughter out of joy, right? So what they did to study rats, I don't know what the study is, but they put cat hair in the rat's cage, and that triggered everyone's, their defense alarms, right? Like we're not safe because cats. And that would take days for the rats to re-regulate, the baby rats, right? These are young baby rats. Even when the cat hair was removed, it would take days for the rats to feel safe again. And during that time, they couldn't play. But once they were finally regulated and could play, they overplayed. Like intense overplaying, could not rest, playing until they were completely exhausted.
Like flight play.
Yeah. Like ADHD restlessness.
Yes. And then she talked about how the medication for ADHD doesn't actually help ADHD. It turns off the play system, which actually keeps trauma kids who are misdiagnosed, or adults who are misdiagnosed as ADHD, in a defensive trauma state.
Yeah. It's like an excellent fawning medication.
Yes, she said it was a fawning pill.
Yeah.
It makes you look regulated when you're actually being re-traumatized. Mm-hmm. That is horrifying.
Right. Yeah.
We're just gonna have to leave that there for right now.
There was one more piece about the study with play that I thought was really neat, interesting, important. Cats, as babies, kittens, if they aren't given the opportunity to play and they're constantly in a state of danger, when they're adults, they have learned all the things, all the skills about how to be a cat and survive, except for socialization. So they are either very aggressive to other cats, or they are completely isolated from other cats. They can survive in any other way, like a normal, healthy adult cat, but they do not know how to be around other cats.
Are you telling me this because of the whole cat thing? The skittish cat thing? I am a cat!
You're a cat that never got to play as a kitten.
It's true.
Yeah.
That was not an option.
Yeah.
I was either contained or working.
Right.
Like very, very, we're not going to talk about it, contained.
Yeah.
Those were my options, and they weren't mine.
No.
The options were not mine. Those were my two experiences, two polarized experiences.
Yeah.
Wait, what does that say? Even taking my story off the table, because who wants to talk about that? What does that say for all those shiny, happy babies who can't get to their toys?
Mm-hmm.
And now we have a whole generation of ADHD kids that are really actually traumatized,
right,
and disconnected from their play system.
Right. So now we have a whole generation of adults who are either really isolated or really aggressive because they don't know how to do it.
Which goes back to the polarized politics and things like we were talking about the other day.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. It's so distressing.
Mm-hmm. It really is. So anything else we need to say about that, or shall we move on?
We need to move on.
I have one more piece on the play system, if that's okay.
No.
Before we jump forward.
No, don't do it. Don't do it.
Well, it's talking about video games and how so much of children these days are growing up with screens and video games. And how that is like combining our play motivation system with avoidance. And so they connect play with avoiding others and not actually connecting to people.
So then those get paired.
Yeah.
And then we have adults who are, again, isolated or aggressive because play and interaction has not been paired.
Right.
So it's an example of deprivation.
Yeah.
So then we have adults who literally cannot communicate with each other.
And don't know how to play with other people, right? Yeah. Oh, she also talked about how children become obsessed with objects rather than people when they lose that attachment.
So they're also going to grow up to be hoarders.
Yeah.
Hoarders who cannot play with other people and who are either aggressive or isolated.
Yeah.
That's frightening.
Yeah. Yay, smartphones. Then she talks about, oh. Are you with me?
It's so hard.
You went somewhere.
I'm sorry. It's so hard. I'm here. I'm ready.
You sure?
No.
I don't want to push.
It's not pushing. It's just uncomfortable.
Okay.
Also pushing.
But it's safe and manageable enough?
Safe and manageable enough. Thank you, Nicole Black, for language.
That was actually Nicole Black quoting Wendy Lemke.
Oh, nope. I was in a trance for Wendy.
Yes, you were. Okay. Then she talks about safety and how important safety is and how safety is not a like one and done check. We got there. We're safe. It is a constant negotiating and responding to what is happening moment to moment. And what can feel safe one moment doesn't necessarily feel safe the next moment.
So I feel like rather than now time is safe, like as a fact, and I know we've talked about that with like safe enough time, I feel like it's what was taught to me as a statement is actually a question.
Yeah.
Is now time safe?
Enough.
Enough. Is now time safe enough? How is now time safe enough?
Yeah.
Why? What is the evidence? What makes now time safe enough?
What do you need to make now time safe enough?
Right. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm reclaiming NTIS, which I really appreciate, but I'm reclaiming it because I'm defining all of those things differently and getting to qualify them myself.
Right. And even with that, like, you know how when you're a child, you have to learn your ABCs and then you learn to read and then you learn how to have more complex things and then you can learn to write, right? It's maybe it was like that, where now time is safe was your ABCs and that's the capacity you had at that time. And then you learned about safe enough. And now you're learning like how to question, right? So it's all developmentally appropriate.
And you know what's interesting? I think I'm to a new place that's not just questioning, but also reassuring.
Yeah.
If now time is not safe enough, I know what to do to take care of myself.
Yeah.
If now time is safe enough, I know why and how to see the evidence of that and how to reassure myself or selves of that, which I feel like is a big deal.
Yeah.
So it's like level up. Level 3 NTIS. NTIS 3. 3.0.
Well done. Oh, okay. Can I just read a little piece that I wrote about safety?
Please.
Mm-hmm. It says, as long as a child lives in an environment that is unsafe, and
ew,
remember,
I already don't I like know. This.
Remember, attachment is number one. So even if a child is not being physically harmed or physically neglected, if there is no attachment, that is not safe, right?
Because breasts are best.
Oh my goodness.
Just kidding. You know where that came from? It's because when we had Kyrie and her G-tube.
Oh, yeah.
We used to say fed is best.
Yeah.
Because people can be really mean about breastfeeding or bottle mm-hmm. feeding, but she had a G-tube. And it's right. like keeping the child alive and yes. nurtured is best.
Yes. Absolutely.
But this is the same thing, just to like the rats, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's not just about is the child not being harmed and that equates with safety. That actually is almost irrelevant. I know this from studies from working with people in the Middle East. Yes, terrible things are happening in the Middle East. I don't mean to downplay any of that. Mm-hmm. And also, in those places where we can get intervention quickly. So like, and I'm not talking about like starving children that can't escape. That's obviously a problem. But like refugee camps, for example, if we can get those child safe tents set up quickly where they have support and can process, even though what they have been through is traumatic, they are not always traumatized by it.
Mm-hmm.
If they have resources and attachment, so tending to the adults, the same thing as the other study, tending to the adults mm-hmm. so that they can heal the children, then the children are not as impacted, even though it's also true they have been through hard things.
Right.
So whether or not physical or sexual harm is being caused, obviously those are terrible things and it's awful when that happens. But when we talk about safety for children, it has to include attachment and nurture.
Right. Because if they don't have a secure attachment, they are not experiencing safety.
Period.
End of the story. Boom, we're done.
Check.
Let's go swim.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, so in that context, could you start reading over and I'll try not to interrupt even when it feels uncomfortable?
Sure. Okay. As long as a child lives in an environment that is unsafe, the child cannot feel safe. If the parent is not feeling safe, then the parent is parenting from survival, and the parent cannot co-regulate if they are in survival. So sometimes what happens is kiddos learn to co-regulate the parents because parents are stuck in survival mode. Because they are still unsafe from their own attachment wounds.
Really, really uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
And also, and also, this is why when I moved 1,000 miles away, well, also I was working, but when I moved 1,000 miles away, I went by myself first because I had to get settled and regulated and regroup before I could say, okay, who is needing what and what kids are shifting where? Yeah.
It's like on the planes when they say you have to put your own air mask on first. Because you cannot actually parent a child if you're completely dysregulated all the time.
Right, right. It also goes to validate people who maybe did not experience physical harm or sexual abuse, but had parents who themselves had like unresolved trauma or dysregulated systems or overly regulated through those rigid generational trauma responses where they were overly controlled or overly in fight, even if it wasn't physical fight, or overly in flight and could not settle.
Or overly in fawn and always fawning.
There's some shiny happy in that too of who are you fawning for? If you're fawning for God or the church or some other authority, then how are you? You can't be present with what's happening with the children because you're focused.
Well, if you're fawning, that means you're in a flight. You're in an activated state, right? Your nervous system is not settled and you're not feeling safe.
So your children do not feel safe.
Right.
Even if they're not being hit.
Yes. So you're going to love this one.
No, no, I am not.
You have to be connected to your nervous system enough to get constant information about what is needed for safety because it changes moment to moment. So like we have to live in our bodies like all the time.
Wait, what? And also, I feel like this is what I was talking about the other day, where I don't know what is working or how to explain, but I feel like I have come to a new place, another power up, level up, 2.0 kind of a, like, I can tell my body is telling me the truth. Yeah. What feels right and good, what does not feel right and good. I don't always know how to fix it. Or what to do about it or where it's coming from, but I am learning to notice it, and that's new.
Yeah. Well, that almost leads to our next one, which talks about co-regulation. Having, like, we have to learn co-regulation through experience, meaning we have to have a caregiver who is regulating with us before we can learn how to self-regulate. And so when you have adults who have never had a co-regulation, we have people show up in our office, right, who don't know how to regulate, who don't know how to soothe themselves and need time, sometimes years of therapy where we are helping them co-regulate so that they can then start to internalize it and learn how to ground and self-regulate. But it can take years, and that's one of the challenges is you can't just teach someone with trauma the first time, here's how you ground, if they don't even know how to Like, they don't even have the tools to self-regulate because they've never been co-regulated.
I think this is so important in the context of people feeling like they're failing therapy because they can't do the things. Mm-hmm. And then we get, like, therapy shame.
Yeah.
Because we think we're failing therapy.
Well, and therapists get the shame, too, of, like, they're not a good enough therapist because they can't teach clients how to regulate and cope or ground. But that you can't do that until you've actually internalized regulation, which takes co-regulation first.
That's what we should do a session on next year. You wanted to do a session? This is what we could talk about.
That was just one shirt, one moment for 1 second.
Said, hello, hey, shirt
session.
Is this a different moment of your neurological responses?
My safety feels different right now.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
That would be a good session though. Right? I do admit that.
Right?
Yeah.
I think it would be good with a lived experience perspective too of what that feels like. Not that we have to overly disclose, but of knowing intuitively from our own experiences what we're talking about.
Right. Well, and it feels like it should be an explicit part of training for phase one of safety and stability. Like, we have to have built-in attachment treatment so people can experience co-regulation and experience safety long enough to have that learned secure attachment with the therapist and learn how to self-regulate after enough time co-regulating. That's when you can start teaching grounding skills and like how to do it on their own. Until then, it's really just they need to come in and have you help them regulate.
Right. So is that what we're going to call it? Attachment as part of safety and stabilization?
Oh. Phase zero.
Phase zero! I love it! Yes. Okay. Back to our topic.
Well, you want to know what's next?
No, I don't. Don't say it.
It was a video.
Not the camel. Not the weeping camel. This is the point at which I literally left the room and threw up.
You did. Yeah.
It's so bad. Okay. I will put in the show notes the link to this video. But you guys, please, whatever protector parts or keeping you safe parts are there, please do not watch the video if mother hunger is too much.
Oh, yeah.
It is mother hunger level content. It is a short, like maybe 6 or 8 minute video, but it is painful, and I literally had to leave the room and throw up. Like, other people in the room were crying. I had to go vomit. So I'll put the link in the show notes. Maybe, seriously, I'm not even kidding. If you are in a place to watch it, literally wait and watch with your therapist.
Yes.
I'm not even kidding. It's not, there's nothing graphic. It's actually a very gentle video, but what it stirs up in a mother hunger context is brutal. So please, especially if you have any mother hunger issues, like we're talking seriously advanced topics, please do not be gentle with yourselves and maybe watch it with your therapist. I'm not kidding.
Don't watch it late at night while you're already stuck in a shame spiral.
No, don't do it. So this video is like, it happens in Mongolia. Mm-hmm. It is documentary style or a clip from a documentary. Mm-hmm. It's a nomadic family and they have a camel, like an adult mama camel who has rejected the baby.
But she had rejected the baby because the birth was traumatic and really hurt the mom. Like, mom almost didn't make it. So mom had a very painful birth and then rejected baby because of the trauma.
See, I keep leaving that part out because the rejection piece was so hard.
Yeah.
It could not settle.
Yeah. But I think it's important to see the balance of, like, mom didn't just decide, hey, I don't want to be a mom. See ya. Like, legit, mom had trauma and could not accept baby because of the trauma.
Yeah, I can't even.
I'm sorry.
No. I'm just being honest that that's part of what was so hard for me.
Yeah.
So hard for me. Like, I'm going to have to come back to this in therapy, like, 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. Sorry, therapist.
Note, put a calendar.
No!
5 years from now. What is that? 2029. Little note on your calendar. The Weeping Camel song.
Ugh. So, anyway, the same is what Anna has said in the presentation about tending to and regulating with and bringing healing to the parent before we can heal the child. This woman is very gently, like, the camel is struggling, is afraid, did not get to bond with the baby because of the traumatic birth. And so they have gotten the camel up. The camel is there. The camel wants away. The camel wants to flight from mm-hmm. danger. So they have the camel kind of on a leash, mm-hmm. but to keep it there to participate. But they have brought out someone to play this stringed instrument that's very kind of trancey. So mm-hmm. again, just the content warning, please watch this with your therapist and not by yourself. And they have this woman singing to the camel.
And stroking the camel.
And stroking, very gently touching the camel. So some physical contact and this song. And I thought it was interesting the way she was stroking the camel was one hand at a time. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like this bilateral experience. Mm-hmm. And singing this song to the camel. So literally co-regulating with the camel before they do anything with the baby.
And the whole tribe or community, all the people are there sitting around, like a little bit away, but there, quietly, but presence. And the rest of the camels are sitting around, quietly, but present.
So, yes. Yeah, so she talked about how we need community for healing. Mm-hmm. And this example of the people just, it was a sacred ceremony, mm-hmm. just really circled around safely, singing this song to the camel, but that very naturally, all the camels in the herd also laid down mm-hmm. and were just sort of in this collective trance, but in a healing way, not a scary kind of trance, but like in a healing trance, like everyone just focused on this mama camel that needed healing. Mm-hmm. And only as the mama camel settled, then they brought the baby to her. And there was a painful moment then too, because she is on the leash, so she can't flight. Like, she wanted to flight, but she couldn't flight. So then she sort of fights, because that comes next, right? When you can't get away, then we move to fight. So she kind of wanted to fight, push away the baby a little bit, push away the leash a little bit, which makes sense. But the woman just goes back to her song mm-hmm. and stroking the camel and singing the song.
And baby also wanted to get away, did not want to be there.
The baby knew she was not safe.
Mm-hmm. And all the handlers helped keep them close so they couldn't just fight, but protected so they weren't also hurting each other.
Right, and they weren't hurting the camels either. Like, right. It was not a restraint kind mm-hmm. of leash. It was a stay here with us. Mm-hmm. We're here with you. You don't have to go through this alone kind of mm-hmm. holding them. And they never forced the baby and the mother together. No. There was some guiding because the mother did not have capacity to guide the baby. Mm-hmm. So they did kind of help guide the baby to drink from the mother and guided the mother in letting the baby drink, but not in an aggressive or forceful mm-hmm. way. It all was very slowly and really in rhythm to the song and the stroking. It was so powerful. And then, if this were not painful enough, when the baby finally latched to the camel, the mama camel began to cry.
Like legit tears.
And so it's called the weeping camel because the camel actually cried from being reunited and feeling safe. Mm-hmm. Like what a traumatic experience, right. And then such healing in it.
And you could even feel the energy shift as mom and baby worked through the trauma and were able to kind of process it, and it was like they re-regulated together and then settled finally into this relief. And that's when baby could latch, and that's when mom started crying. And then the handlers were able to let go of the leads and walk away and give mom and baby space, and they did not want to leave. They were good together.
Yeah, everyone just let go and backed away further. And then the baby felt safe with the mother. The mother wanted her baby. And so everyone just backed away so that they could do what they needed to do. And it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And also I went and threw up and then cried for like 2 hours.
I think what's really important about that is the piece where you need community. Like you need a whole village to make it safe enough, because mom can't co-regulate in that moment and baby doesn't know how to co-regulate. So they really needed other people around to support that healing, and neither of them could have done it alone. And that wasn't because either of them were bad. You can't heal trauma alone.
Exactly. And it wasn't even anyone's fault.
Right.
Like both were distressed. We could hold space for all yes. of the pain. Right. It was an example again of brave spaces. Mm-hmm. We're just going to be with this pain together. In some ways also, it really reminded me of all the online stuff in the last year of like everyone is just hurting. And like instead of appropriating that or shouting about that, like let's just hold space for pain together. And learning together and healing, and this was traumatic. But as a community, we are the ones who just let it heal. And as a community, we tend to each other. And as a community, we hold space, whether it's now time difficulties or hard conversations or challenges or learning to do better or memory time stuff that we just support one another through because we're all hurting.
Yeah.
That was one thing we talked about at ISSDD a lot this year, was how with so much lived experience and all of us hurting, that we do get relational things wrong because we don't know. Like that baby camel connecting to the mother is what would keep the baby camel alive.
Mm-hmm.
But the baby camel just knew it's not safe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So didn't know that that's what would nourish or help.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes sense when we feel isolated or disconnected from each other, that we don't feel like when we don't feel safe, we then are isolated from what heals us.
Yeah.
But when we as a community pull together and support each other and just let things heal and move forward, not in a dismissive way, not in an ignoring what hurts, but in honoring together this hurt. Let's just share the feelings, say the things, do the things, mm-hmm. hold presence with each other, and also give space for things to heal. Mm-hmm. As long as we are not feeling safe, we also cannot heal.
Right. If we didn't have community to hold us together in that moment when they brought camel, mom and baby together, and they were able to just flight or fight, and they got stuck in that, there would have been no healing. It would have been more trauma and more rupture. But having that community hold space for them without letting them get stuck in the defense. That's what brought the healing.
And again, no one being in trouble.
Right.
Just you're hurting and we love you.
Yeah.
And I'm so sorry there is hurt. It is easier for me to externalize it. Like, even that is not easy. I don't mean to minimize that at all. But it is easier to see it externally than to apply it internally, because that feels really painful. What does that look like to be my own weeping camel? Because, like, in my example, like, my parents are dead, right? I didn't get a weeping camel moment. Yeah. So there's grief too, externally, which is valid in a whole different episode, right? But internally, with myself, with my system, with my guild.
I love it.
What does that look like to just circle around in a healing circle kind of way, mm-hmm. and hold space to let healing in instead of only running away from the things that are good for me,
right?
That are literally my nourishment.
And running away is not, that's our natural response, right? And we can't not do that unless we have someone else there to help hold safety, right? I think that's key. Someone else who is regulated has to be there to hold space for us to work through the fight and flight and get back to safe.
That's why we need therapy, because we need an outside other for the co-regulating,
yeah.
for presence, for witnessing, mm-hmm. so that we have enough literal space to do the healing of connecting with what has hurt, with what has felt dangerous.
Right, without getting lost in the trauma response. We have that anchor to help bring us back.
Safe so enough. Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Please tell me that's all there was.
The only other fun thing was...
Sorry. It's been so much fun so far.
No, this really is a fun one.
Oh, okay.
The one where she talks about the different ways she acknowledges multiplicity and wholeness, where she talks about, like, there's one rainbow, but there's lots of colors in the rainbow, and each color is its own color, and it's still a part of the one rainbow. Or there's a tree with lots of leaves, and so each part can be a leaf, and it's its own leaf, but it's also part of the tree. And she also said one that's, like, more relevant. She said, there's one iPhone, but there's lots of apps.
That's amazing.
Right? But all part of one phone.
What if that's finally my system name? The Rainbow Guild.
I love it.
I have all these years been like, system names, whatever, you people. What if that's it? What if it finally came?
Maybe that's it.
Rainbow Guild.
I love you.
Oh, I love you too. You can take that out if you want.
But that was the last piece. We don't have to talk about it anymore.
I want to clarify if that is actually the last piece or just the last piece you want to talk about.
Well, the rest of it is like techniques she uses therapy with. Like, so that's not really stuff we would talk about.
It's just double checking if that was avoidance or actuality. I'm sorry for doubting.
No, it's okay. It's okay. It's a legit question, I think. I've earned it.
Oh my goodness, that's really powerful. Mm-hmm. Rainbow Guild.
Rainbow Guild. You're the RG.
Yes! RG. You know what I like about it, seriously, is that I like the colors, the rainbow metaphor, that there's one rainbow, but lots of colors. Mm-hmm. I also like that colors can blend. Mm-hmm. And I like the guild concept, not because I'm a gamer in the way you are. I tried and it was embarrassingly pathetic.
Well,
I just can't even fly on a dragon.
No, here's the thing. You were like level 5. And you were fighting level 60 or 70 dragons. Anyone that's a gamer will know how that's not okay. It wasn't your fault. You were in the wrong place.
Well, I Dragonflight was coming out, uh-huh. and I threw you a dragon party.
You did.
And I really wanted to, I knew I didn't understand, but I really wanted to understand that part of the world because it was important to you. Mm-hmm. So I tried it out. Mm-hmm. And up until that point, all dragons had been friendly.
Yeah.
But there was like this place where you're supposed to get to an island. And I sort of found not a cheat, but I accidentally got on the boat. But I didn't actually qualify to be on the boat. And so I was really proud of myself for getting on the boat. But I got off the boat and a dragon ate me repeatedly.
Yeah. Well, every time you got back to your body to res, you were eaten again.
Because my body was there by the dragon who just continued to eat me. It was chronic ongoing trauma.
It was. You were stuck in a trauma loop, right?
I was in a trauma loop. It was awful. But seriously, the whole guild concept, which I've never done because nobody wants me on their team, which also feels like real life. Mm. So now I can be my own guild. Yeah. But you told me about guilds because you have done the thing and we don't have to talk about your stuff. But you explained what a guild is to me and how people work together with different strengths. And now you've talked about the tank concept. And so gamers out there are like, oh my goodness!
You're going to get so much emails about gamers. I'm sorry.
No, I love it. But you just got all the cool points the podcast never had. Because I'm like, here's a new book. But having all these different strengths and experts and different things, I'm still not using the right words, but having all of that work together makes sense to me. Yeah. Like, this is where I'm at in therapy. I have to work together to do the hard thing.
Yeah.
I know I'm ready to do the hard thing. I know it. Mm-hmm. And I have a good therapist who can be my, who can be regulated enough to let me do my thing, to help me to hold presence while I do the hard things. I know, seriously, not fawning. I know that I'm ready to go there, but it is terrifying, but I have her and I can only do it if I include all of me.
Right. You have to build a full team. And what I like is you've already had everyone there waiting. They're just like in separate rooms with doors. So they haven't actually been able to meet and work together. But
because I hate the conference table.
Right.
But I can do guild.
Meet in an inn. Where there's like
beer, video game beer.
There you go. Meet at the, I can't think of the word right now. Like
I want the tavern. Little, a tavern and little biscuits.
Yes, biscuits and beer.
What do they call the little biscuits?
Oh, there's all kinds of names for them.
I want my little biscuit. Okay, don't laugh at me. But if we're going to use our imagination here, I want my little biscuits to be like the Alice in Wonderland ones, where in icing it spells WOW for World of Warcraft. Oh my
goodness. You can have that.
But I feel like, okay, we're gathering. I feel it preparatory. Like, I don't like using that word because for me it's a religious trauma word. Mm-hmm. But I feel almost not eagerness, but anticipation that like, the side quest is here. We are ready to start some side quest. I maybe am not ready for the dungeon, but I know what a side quest is. And I maybe even in my journal have a list of side quests.
Do you want another word for not side quests, but more like dungeons and main quests? There are campaign quests. It's your campaign.
Ooh, campaign quest. Oh my goodness. We are going to go on a side quest to lunch.
We are.
Well done. Good conferencing. Thanks, Texas. We had a lovely time.
We did. Now let's just hope our plane isn't late or canceled.
Well, more queso for us. Thank you for listening. Your support of the podcast, the workbooks, and the community means so much to us as we try to create something together that's never been done before. Not like this. Connection brings healing.
And you can join us on the community at www.systemspeak.com. We'll see you there.